Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The U.S.-Mexico border and the treacherous terrain that surrounds it has been the backdrop for countless films and novels. It's been a hotly contested topic for years, reaching a boiling point with the current presidential administration, as politicians scramble to line up on both sides of the issue. Some shout for a wall and more enforcement. Others demand a path to citizenship for immigrants who are already here and those still likely to come. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. No matter how we view the border and the issues surrounding it, most of us will never understand what it feels like to cross it or to police it. That's why Francisco Cantu joined the Border Patrol after studying immigration issues in college, a desperate desire to know what life was like in the field and an earnest hope to gain perspective. His new book is called The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. Francisco, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So had you been mulling over the idea of joining the Border Patrol for a while, or did it just kind of sneak up on you and you decided to act on it?
You know, I spent most of my time as an undergraduate studying immigration and border issues, and I was definitely not a law enforcement-minded person, as you can imagine. I was a senior, and you know, I was starting to think about what I wanted to do when I was going to graduate, and I was at a job fair, mm-hmm. and the Homeland Security Department had a booth, and I walked by, and I sort of, you know, like laughingly picked up this brochure for the Border Patrol, and you know, I was completely obsessed with the border. I knew I wanted to go back to Arizona, but I had absolutely never thought about joining the Border Patrol, and I sort of was scoffing at this brochure, but I took it home, and the more I like looked at it and thought about it, I was like, you know, actually, these like this is one of the only jobs that would really allow me to be back in the Southwest, on the border, day in and day out. I really longed for, you know, a more intimate knowledge beyond the book knowledge that I had acquired in school, and kind of counterintuitively, it started to seem like the best way to get that knowledge.
So your mom was a park ranger when you were growing up. Is getting to know that landscape as a child, is that part of what kind of pushed you toward working that land in a different way when you grew up?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up very close to the outdoors because of my mother. And I had a real sense for the desert as a landscape and as a place of beauty. And I think, leaving the Southwest to go to college and studying the border through all these, you know, books and policy memos and you know, doing this research at a think tank, it felt very divorced from the reality that I knew growing up of the desert and of the landscape. And so that was actually a big part of what appealed to me about the Border Patrol, is I knew that it would be a way of spending a lot of time outdoors. And although I think my mother was horrified, part of that experience of growing up so close to the landscape was definitely something that made the Border Patrol more appealing to me.
And that was my very next question. Your mom, not thrilled by your career move. She didn't just let this go. This came up between you and your mom time and time again. Why did she not want you to go this direction?
You know, I think my mother was not only terrified for my personal safety, as I think any mother would be. Mm-hmm. You know, she was also concerned for the health of my soul. And I think she foresaw a lot of the ways that kind of work requires you to become numb to certain realities and to the humanity of the people that you encounter in that job, because you do it on a day in, day out basis. And in order to do that job, you sort of have to detach from the individual stories of the people that you're apprehending, right? I mean, you would be overwhelmed if you took each one of those stories home with you at the end of the day. And I think my mom knew that, and she was scared that I was stepping into this system in which I might lose a sort of sense for my own humanity and for the humanity of others.
She thought you may stay detached?
I'm sorry?
Did she think you might stay detached and not be able to come back to yourself?
Absolutely. And really, looking back on it, my mother was sort of the only person in my life that was holding me accountable the entire time, you know, throughout all those years I spent in the Border Patrol. She was always there, you know, to remind me and interrogate me about who I was before I joined the Border Patrol and the reasons that I had given her for joining the Border Patrol. And she was always sort of, you know, it felt like nagging at the time, but she was, you know, concerned that I was losing sight of those reasons for joining. And, you know, she kept me tethered to who I was outside of that job in a way that was really important. And that's why she's such a big part of the book.
So tell me about your time at the academy. What were the other men and women in your training class like?
So the Border Patrol is, it's the largest law enforcement agency in the country. There's something like 18,000 agents. And agents come from all walks of life. I think I definitely had maybe some preconceived notions about what kind of people I'd be working with. Mm-hmm. And I really saw all of that sort of become complicated and turned on its head. I mean, I was at the academy. I was surprised that I think close to half of the Border Patrol agents nationally are Hispanic or Latino. Many of them have roots in the Southwest or in border areas. Many of them are children of immigrants themselves. Some of them might have been brought over as young people. You know, some of them might have literally been dreamers. And so, you know, you have a lot of former law enforcement, a lot of former military people, but you also have like people whose only job was working at Dairy Queen, or people who had PhDs or master's degrees. So I really encountered like people from all walks of life, and you know, some of the most humanitarian, compassionate people that I've ever met, and sure, some people that I, you know, really disagreed with.
An interesting characterization in the book, one of the agents in your training class, a Black American, I think from Detroit, and he said that he had worked at a car rental counter before, and he was kind of laughing with you while you were out to eat, but then all of a sudden he said, you know how many people never would take one look at me with tattoos on my arms and then not look me in the eye. What do you think the training experience and joining the Border Patrol meant to him?
I think it meant to him what it means to a lot of people joining the Border Patrol, a real opportunity to move forward. I mean, it's a federal job with amazing benefits. The pay structure increases very quickly if you're able to stay in the job and do the work. I mean, it's more money than I'll probably ever make again, certainly than I'll make as a writer. and it's also, you know, so many people see this job as service, the same way that people who join the military are joining because they want to serve. You know, so you have a lot of people, you know, who are doing it not because they want to, you know, keep brown people out of the U.S. You know, they're doing it because it really represents a way of serving their country, and it's something that makes their families proud and, you know, makes them look at themselves in a different light.
What was the training like? Did it weed a lot of people out? Was it pretty intense?
It does weed a lot of people out. It's very similar to what you would imagine. It's sort of a hybrid between like a boot camp and a police academy. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of law, and you have to really, you know, do a lot of book learning to learn the immigration law. When do you have the right to pull over a car? When do you have a right to search and seize a vehicle? All these things. But then there's also the firearms training, and there's also the physical training, and that part of it would probably look to somebody on the outside a lot more like boot camp. So yeah, you get yelled at a lot. And, you know, the idea in the Border Patrol Academy, just like all of these other types of training, is to sort of, you know, break you down and build you back up again in the image of a law enforcement agent.
So once you graduated and started working, in the very first few days, you guys came upon a pretty significant load of drugs. What happened that night?
For me, that was the first time, you know, the first seizure in the field that I was ever a part of. And what I remember is that we tracked a group of drug smugglers who were, you know, carrying these bundles on their back. And they left these bundles of marijuana at the base of the mountains and kind of scrambled up the mountains and got away from us before we even arrived. And so we, you know, secured the drugs. And, you know, I remember it as sort of being this scene of pandemonium. And, you know, they had left their backpacks. There were the marijuana bundles, but there were also the backpacks that they were carrying with their food and clothing and personal belongings. And so, you know, people, we were a big group of agents that were fresh off the academy. And so we were just sort of like turned loose, and people were like rifling through these backpacks and, you know, sort of like crushing the food and going through the belongings and smoking the cigarettes that were in there. And, yeah, just kind of hung back and watched.
I mean, did you expect it to feel like it did that day? I mean, was that something that you were mentally prepared for, or was it overwhelming when that happened?
I don't think it was overwhelming, because I think I had been, you know, so conditioned to, by the time you get in the field, you know, you've already become conditioned to accept some of the things that you're going to encounter. And so it was a strange experience writing this book, because, you know, a lot of describing a scene like that, for example, in the book, it comes out of a journal entry that I made. And looking back at it, you know, all these years later, when I started to write this book, it was simultaneously, you know, the most normal thing that I had just made a journal entry about, like, here's a day at work. And at the same time, with a little bit of distance from it, I could start to recognize how it seemed kind of crazy. And so I didn't feel alarmed or overwhelmed in that moment, but I felt, I feel kind of alarmed when I think about it now.
And we should say you did not catch the smugglers, right? You just recovered the drugs, and that wasn't that unusual.
No, that wasn't that unusual. There's sort of an unspoken policy that I don't know how widespread this is. I don't know if it's something that has changed in the time that I've left. But, you know, if you encounter an abandoned load of narcotics, it's much less paperwork to just write that up as an abandoned drug load in the desert than to actually chase down and apprehend those people, because then you have a different kind of case, right? You have a smuggling case, and you have suspects that you need to prosecute and bring to court, and that entails a whole different set of rules and regulations and paperwork. And what it really entails is a lot more hours behind a computer on the job.
Our guest this hour is Francisco Cantu. His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
I'm I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think. Our guest this hour is Francisco Cantu. His book is called The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. And we've been talking about your time as a Border Patrol agent in the field. We should say you were in the field between what you were in the Border Patrol 2008 to 2012. So not
That's right.
super recently, but definitely in recent memory. Talk to me about some of those really heartbreaking stories of people you apprehended trying to cross. There were so many that really stuck with me. What's the one you look back on most often, the one person or couple or group of people that you can't seem to stop thinking about?
You know, there's several. I think when I had some distance from the Border Patrol, when I first started thinking about putting together this book, I realized that the moments that really stuck with me the most, that I was still carrying with me, were these like individual interactions. It wasn't the car chases or the drug busts. So one encounter that I think about a lot, and that's sort of emblematic of a lot of the themes of the book, I encountered a man and his pregnant wife who had been left behind in the desert by their guide because they couldn't keep up with the group. And, they showed up in a village and were in a church, and it was just my job to sort of take them back to the station. And I started having a conversation with the woman, and she had grown up in the U.S. and she spoke perfect English, and she was a school teacher. And her husband saw that we sort of had a connection and that we were speaking in English, and then he sort of asked me in Spanish, hey, you know, can we skip the whole deportation thing? Could you just take us, you know, drive us down to the border and let us go, and we'll walk back, and that'll be that. And, you know, at the time, of course, there was no hesitation. I said, no, you know, this is my job, and you know that, and I have to take you in. And so I brought them back to the office and started processing them for, you know, taking their belongings and all of that, logging their money. And I remember specifically asking for their names, like introducing myself to them and asking who they were and asking them to be safe and wishing them luck. And like a couple hours later, sitting in my car, I had forgotten their names already. And at the time, you know, that was normal, I guess. But looking back on it, you know, that was a subtle way, a subtle example of how people are dehumanized, right? And how people, these migrants are seen by Border Patrol agents and by the public at large as these sort of like nameless, faceless people who are just part of an undifferentiated mass.
And you have a few stories in the book of people who were actually waiting to be processed for deportation, who volunteered to do like work around the station just to prove that they were good people. Did that kind of knock you over?
You know, that's one of those things that is almost a platitude, right? We hear, you know, there's good guys and bad guys, and a lot of the people who are coming are just coming for work, and you hear that so much that it almost means nothing. You're like, yeah, okay. But that incident that you mentioned, you know, I brought this guy in from the field, and I was just, you know, rolling his fingerprints and asking him the sort of standard questions in order to put him into the system. And, you know, he just looked at me and he's like, hey, you know, I know that that we have to wait around for a couple hours. Can I clean the cells? Can I take out the trash? Can I sweep the floor? And I remember thinking, oh, you know, you don't get it. Like, that's not what this is. This is just a waiting area. And then kind of explaining to him, you know, you're going to get on a bus. They're going to take you to the next town. And then you're going to be back in Mexico in a couple of days. Like, don't worry about it. And he's like, no, I understand all that. Like, I get it. But I want to show you that I'm here to work. Like, I want to do good while I'm here. And that was really powerful for me because you hear that, right? Like, you know that in your mind, but it's different when somebody's standing in front of you and saying, give me work. I'm here to work.
Thankfully, because there are so many stories that will break you to pieces when you hear them, but there's some really kind of unexpected humor in some of the interactions you had with people who were trying to cross. I remember this kind of jovial encounter you had with two men, and they had a backpack full of some like great Mexican delicacies, and you guys all kind of ate together and joked around. Tell us what happened that day.
Yeah, so we apprehended these two guys very, very close to the border. They hadn't been out too long. They hadn't been lost or disoriented. And so, you know, they still kind of had some energy. And they sort of, you know, quite often when you're arresting these people, I mean, they know that they're captured. In my experience, they most often didn't even run. It was like, oh, you got us. And you know, they know the drill. And that was the story with these guys. And when you get them back to the station, you kind of have to throw away any perishable items. And so we was going through their backpack back at the station, and they had like dried fish and dried crickets, like covered with salt and lime, and all this food from Oaxaca. They were Oaxacan. And, you know, as we were like about to throw each one of these items away, they're like, oh, hey, like, don't throw that away, man. That stuff's good. Like, have you tried charrales before? Have you tried, you know,
there's jerky too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Carne seca. They had everything. And they're like, oh, you know, that's not any carne seca. Like we made that on our ranch. Like, you should try that. And, you know, so those instances, those interactions became interesting to me because, you know, you don't think about that. Like, you share moments of humanity, and of course you're in a position of great privilege and power over these people. But, you know, I remember them saying, like, don't throw away that bottle of mezcal. Like, take that home with you. Like, you know, that's mezcal that our father made. You know, you should cherish that.
Let's take a call now. The number to call is 800-933-5372. We'll hear from Manuel in San Antonio. Go ahead.
Hi. What did you see in their eyes when they realized you weren't there to help them but to arrest them? Considering that maybe they recognized that agent looks like me, Hispanic or Latino.
What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that moment in the desert when you encounter somebody is such a moment of extreme vulnerability. And, you know, to answer the caller's question, you know, it's sort of different every time because people are in different situations. Sometimes you're showing up and you're literally, your presence is long awaited, and you're rescuing somebody who's been lost, and, you know, maybe they've found their way to the road and they're flagging people down and they're just trying to get anybody to stop for them. And sometimes, you know, you've chased them down and, you know, the adrenaline has to go out of both of your systems. And I remember one encounter in particular. It was the first time I ever saw a dead body in the desert. And, it was a middle-aged man who had died from dehydration. And, he was with like his 19-year-old nephew, from the same village where he was from, and that nephew's friend. And so I was the agent on scene that spoke fluent Spanish. So all of a sudden I was sort of, you know, explaining this kind of incomprehensible bureaucracy to these two boys who had just seen, you know, their uncle die. And I remember the look in their eyes just being one of sort of like utter detached, like, just kind of incomprehensibility, right? Like this was an incomprehensible place. This was an incomprehensible person. The things that I was saying to them, you know, sort of all they knew was that they needed to nod their head and say yes, because I was a man in uniform. So I hope that answers the caller's question in some way.
And I think that brings us to kind of a tough to confront reality that many of us probably know happens but don't really have to confront, which is the idea that people do die crossing the desert, trying to get across the border. What was it like to have to experience that more than once and have to deal with that reality almost every time you were out?
If there's one issue that I carry with me and that I feel the most passionate about after those years in the Border Patrol, it is this issue of people dying in the desert. The station where I worked for most of my career was a remote station in the desert. And, you know, we have this policy in place that is sort of enforcement through deterrence, in which, you know, the urban areas are heavily patrolled, and that pushes the crossing out to these very remote desert areas where it was once thought people wouldn't even try to cross because they're so far flung. But of course, we have seen that to not be true. And so it really serves to sort of weaponize the landscape. And so, you know, I'm someone who's encountered those people countless times, right? These are people that I tried to represent in the book. You know, people with silver dollar sized blisters on their feet, people who, you know, were dehydrated, near death, delusional. And you know, to me, that's a humanitarian crisis that I don't think we talk about to the extent that we should be talking about it. And, you know, we don't acknowledge that in our conversation about enforcement and reform. I think that's one of the very first things that has to change if we're going to reform the system. And so, you know, we also don't acknowledge those people. Those people are often unidentified. We don't have names for them. You don't read their obituaries in the paper. So to me, that's sort of unacceptable, and it has to change.
And you said oftentimes, I mean, there wasn't really much hope of even getting the body returned to the community they came from, or even getting documentation of what had happened easily back. I know that's something you said the nephew was really concerned about in that incident you described earlier. It was tough to even move forward in death.
I mean, I really remember those boys not wanting to leave the body. And I think, you know, like that body represents so much. And to just walk away from it and then to just trust this person in uniform who, as the person who was explaining what was going to happen to that body to these boys, I didn't even know. I was like, well, you know, the tribal police are going to come and they're going to take possession of the body, and then they're going to turn it over to the medical examiner, and then the medical examiner is going to contact the Mexican consulate, and then give your information to the Mexican consulate, and maybe you'll hear from the Mexican consulate. I mean, it's insanity. I mean, that's no comfort for someone who you're going to send back to their village with a huge absence hanging over them and have nothing to show for it and nothing to explain that absence.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Talk to me about the nightmares that you were grappling with as you served as a Border Patrol agent. They were recurring. They were really wearing on you. And there was a couple themes that repeated themselves over and over again.
Yeah. You know, for many years, I sort of pushed those dreams away. And the only reason that I ever sort of confronted them was, as you say, because they didn't go away. They were recurring. And so I would have dreams where I would encounter dead bodies in the desert, like the one I had found, or where people I had arrested and sent back would kind of come back to me. I remember one dream, I was literally sort of encountered with all of these like faceless people in a canyon. And you know, the one dream that I had over and over and over again, was a dream in which my teeth would sort of crumble in my mouth and fall out of my mouth into my hands. And then, you know, I would like stare at my face in the mirror, and I would be this sort of disfigured person. And I remember a few years after I started having those dreams, I went in for a dental appointment, and I found out that I had been grinding my teeth in my sleep, which was a problem that I had never had before. And the dentist, you know, asked me, you know, are you stressed? Do you have a stressful job? And at the time, you know, I said no. It didn't seem like I had a stressful job. It was so normal to me. I mean, that job had become so normalized to me. But, you know, the dentist said to me, you know, like, you've worn through several layers of enamel in your molars. And so that was a moment in which I really had to sort of sit up and look at myself and realize that something wasn't right and that I wasn't okay, and because that was a real world manifestation of this sort of subconscious horror that I'd been having.
Did you do any Googling on that teeth dream? I mean, is it a powerlessness issue? Is that something you were really struggling with? Was your powerlessness to really change anything?
Yeah, I Googled and went on to the, you know, dream blogs and chat rooms and stuff, and then much later on I was reading Freud and Jung. Yeah, I think those dreams are a representation of stress first and foremost, and who knows, I think powerlessness is definitely something I grappled with, because I joined the Border Patrol with this sort of naive idea that I would be helping people. I thought that since I spoke Spanish and since I had all this knowledge of the border from school, since I had lived in Mexico and traveled in Mexico and was familiar with a lot of places where people were coming from, that I would, you know, I'd be able to put people at ease or help them. But of course, at the end of the day, I was sending these people back to the place where they were risking their lives to flee. So it was hard to ever really feel good about that.
And you were pretty young when you started working in the field. How old were you?
I think I was 23 when I joined the Border Patrol.
And you were not the only 23-year-old. You actually had like a journeyman trainer that was also 23. What does that say if there's people that young who have had that much experience? Is there just a lot of people getting hired in and out of Border Patrol?
Yeah, you know, I came in as part of the Bush hiring surge. I was sort of part of the tail end of that hiring surge. And as a 23-year-old, I was sort of in the middle of the age range. There were many agents that were younger than me. You know, there's like 18-year-olds whose only job was, you know, working at restaurants or something like that. So the military and a lot of law enforcement agencies aren't much different. I mean, we're asking young adults to do very hard work that would be hard for, you know, a completely matured, fully formed person to carry out. And it's happening at like a formative time in your life. You know, I was 23. I was still figuring out how to relate to people and like how to be a person in the world. So it was a strange time to do that work.
Our guest this hour is Francisco Cantu. His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. If you want to join the conversation, the number to call is 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERAThink. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Francisco Cantu. His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. We're going to take a call now. First, we'll go to Jose in Fort Worth. The number is 800-933-5372. Jose, go ahead with your question.
Francisco, thank you for bringing this up. And it's terrible, but, you know, I was watching TV the other day, and there was this construction a company that needed 100 people, and they're hurting for hands, but, you know, we're sending them back. And to avoid all of that, they should have, like, the Bracero program that we, at one point in time, we had. I think my dad was one of those people that came in. Wow. It's a Bracero. It was legal and everything. I wonder, I know you telling us all these terrible things that you went through, but, you know, that can be avoided. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Thanks, Jose.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I remember studying the Bracero program and sort of having the same question as Jose has, like, why can't we have something like this? Why doesn't this make sense? And I guess it seems to me that we've arrived at this place in the national discourse where we sort of fixate on the easiest answer. And so I think that's why something like build the wall sounds like it sounds so simple. It sounds like such a simple answer for people who live far away from the border and have no conception of it as a place with its own culture. And it seems like the edge of the earth to them, and this seems like a problem to them. So why not build a wall? That sounds easy. And
would you mind real quick, can you explain the Bracero program for people who aren't familiar with what that is?
Sure. So the Bracero program was a program in, I believe, the 1950s. It was basically a guest worker program, mm-hmm. and it was big in Texas, and it was big throughout the Southwest, and it brought it matched farmers and ranchers with people willing to do seasonal farm work from Mexico. And I don't know how long it went on. I think over a decade or something like that. But, you know, I think what we need is a willingness to have these conversations in a way that recognizes the incredibly complex nature of the border and the incredibly nuanced nature of these issues, because right now there's an urge to simplify and to paint everything as black or white. You know, it's amnesty, so it's bad, or it's a wall, and that's good. And I think that those are both things that we should reject.
Let's take one more call now. The number 933-5372, 800-933-5372. Let's go to Brad in Houston.
Hello, Courtney and Francisco. Great. Very timely show, and thanks for putting this on for us.
Of course.
My question was regarding prior service agents, your observation of prior service agents, especially those that are prior combat arms and combat veterans themselves. Did they have, what was their ability to adjust to maybe a tighter rules of engagement, or did they carry over perhaps their contempt and hostility for the other side over into mm-hmm. dealing with these people? How are they compared to agents of with other professional backgrounds?
What do you think?
It's a good question. I think that there's a good reason why so many people in the Border Patrol come from a law enforcement background or a military background. In a lot of ways, those people are prepared for the nature of that work. So at the Border Patrol Academy, I saw those people as very well equipped. You know, they were ready for getting yelled at and for going through a lot of intense PT. But I do think that that's an interesting question. It's one that I haven't thought of. You know, in the military, the rules of engagement are so different, right? It's you're engaging with an enemy and you know, you're trained to kill in a way that does not quite match up with the training of law enforcement or Border Patrol. You know, I didn't follow that issue closely enough or pay attention closely enough to the distinction between agents with law enforcement backgrounds or military backgrounds. But what I can say is that in the Border Patrol, there's really not a culture of talking about the ways that you might be impacted by the trauma or the violence of the job. And I think that that's probably similar to military or law enforcement. You know, I've shared some of my writing with a handful of colleagues, people that I worked with, and most of them, the first thing that they say is, you know, wow, I had no idea you were going through so much. I didn't know you were having a hard time with this work. And it's true. It's because I never talked about it. And I think that, you know, those doubts and nightmares, I think, are experiences that a lot of people have who are in these lines of work. And I think that there's a creeping unease about the ways that these jobs cause us to bottle up and set aside our compassion and internalize violence. And, you know, those aren't things that we should be ignoring. I think those are alarm bells, right, that call us back to our sense of humanity.
So you eventually left Border Patrol. First, you left the field for kind of more of a desk job, like an intel unit. But then eventually, what was the moment that you decided to resign completely?
At the time, I don't think I would have told you that I was resigning because I couldn't handle the job or because these dreams had become too much for me. I had applied for a research scholarship to study abroad, and I think that was a way, you know, I think my subconscious was at work in a way in giving me a way out. Exactly. It gave me a way to leave with like a direction forward. It kind of gave me an excuse to leave. But looking back on it, you know, a couple months before I left the Border Patrol, I went and I saw this movie, and it was a movie about a man who becomes kind of unable to distinguish between his dreams and his real life. And so, you know, his dreams seep into his real life, and he's just like kind of goes crazy. It's a psychological thriller. And I remember driving home from that movie and just like really unexpectedly just like breaking down and like having to pull my car over on the side of the road. And I think I saw something of myself, right, happening, being unable to distinguish between who I was in these nightmares and who I was in real life. And I think that that was the first moment where I was like, you know, something's wrong here and this might not be the work for you.
So we could spend a whole nother hour talking about your friendship and with Jose. First of all, how did you meet him?
Jose is a man I met years after I left the Border Patrol. I was in grad school working at a cafe as a barista, and the cafe was in this shopping center. And Jose was the maintenance man for the shopping center. And, you know, every time he had a break, he would come and get a refill on his coffee. He would eat his breakfast at the coffee bar. And so we built a friendship over the course of like 2 years. And then his mother died and he left the country to go back to Oaxaca, where he was from, to attend his mother's funeral. And this is something that happens to a lot of migrants, a lot of people who are here as undocumented immigrants. The first time that they leave the country is because they feel like they have no choice but to go home for the funeral of a loved one. And of course, he had great difficulty crossing the border. He was apprehended. He was put into a deportation process. And because I was familiar with those structures, I ended up being the one who was sort of translating for his family where he was and what was happening and where they needed to go, how to get in touch with him at the prison, literally just sort of interpreting at meetings with his lawyers. And so for me, it was really impactful because that was the first time that I really looked behind the curtain at this deportation industrial complex, really, that is humming along in our country all of the time. And I really saw for the first time how deeply that can rip through people's lives. And I really see that as a way that the border sort of reaches out and affects people and their families even far away from the actual physical border itself.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So as Jose is going through all of this, he knew you had worked for the Border Patrol. Had you ever discussed whether or not he was documented before this happened?
We hadn't actually. I think there was a lot that just sort of went unspoken. I didn't want to assume. It just never really came up. And it was a long time before we even talked about the fact that I had worked in the Border Patrol. I think we had known each other for a year or more by the time I ever, you know, it's not something I went around telling people.
And what struck me when you kind of described him off the top of that section of the book was he was always someone who's always trying to share his breakfast with you. He always wanted you to eat like half of his breakfast burrito and just take what you wanted. Did you include that? Because that's just kind of in essence exactly who he was. He was just wanted to smile and give.
That's who he was. And that's so much of our encounter was sharing these meals together. You know, I opened the coffee shop. I showed up every day at like 6:30 to open the coffee shop, and he was already there, you know, cleaning the grounds. And I got to the point where I just planned on eating breakfast with Jose. I just knew that, you know, I was going to eat half a breakfast burrito, and it was kind of the perfect amount. There are these huge breakfast burritos. It's too much for him to eat. And, you know, he would kind of check in with me. He'd be like, hey, you want black beans or brown or pinto beans today? You know, you want the green salsa or the red salsa? Oh, hey, let's try it with cheese. Let's try it with, you know what I mean? And so that it was just a part of our relationship.
And I know you can't probably reveal everything that's going on with him in his personal timeline. I know in the book that when he was deported, he didn't really shut it out that he wouldn't immediately try to cross again. I mean, that's something that you speak about in the book and that his wife communicated with you. I mean, he wanted to get back to his wife and his three boys. That was his priority over everything else.
So Jose, at the time that he was deported, he'd been living in this country for more than 30 years. And he has three U.S. citizen boys and a wife. And in talking with him, you know, he made no effort to hide the fact that I'm gonna keep crossing until I get over. Like I'm not going to abandon my kids and just go back to my village in Oaxaca and let them have a life without their father. I'm not gonna leave my wife behind. And he's the first person that I ever literally had tell me, and I think that this is probably true. I know that it's true for countless others, that, you know, no matter what version of hell you put in front of me, I'm going to endure it. I'm going to cross over it in order to be with my family.
Do you think that you answered the question by spending those years in the Border Patrol that you set out kind of asking yourself? Do you have that answer now?
No, I really don't. I left the Border Patrol with more questions than I ever went in with. And the border seems vastly more complex and more nuanced than it ever did to me before. And answers to those questions seem harder to me now than they ever did before. So my experience in the Border Patrol, and I think that's probably part of what led me to become a writer, is it was one of the only things that I could do in which it was okay to ask questions and not answer them. And I think part of what I try to do in this book is to leave the reader with those questions too, because I think they're questions that we have to grapple with. I think we have to reject easy answers to those questions. I think we have to search our souls as individuals and as a society and grapple with those questions and you know, struggle through the dark towards an answer.
Is Jose all right?
You know, the truth is that, like so many other people in Jose's situation, he's living a precarious life, and I can't say on which side of the border he is, but I can say that his situation is made worse by the current climate on both sides of the border. You know, for me to say where he is would make him unsafe, and so I can say that he's alive and that we're in touch. And I think, you know, we hear so much about the challenges that face undocumented migrants like Jose, but nothing can be as impactful as an individual story. And that's why his friendship impacted me so much.
Our guest is Francisco Cantu. His book is The Line Becomes River, Dispatches from the Border. Francisco, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a really interesting conversation.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.